Blog Talk Radio.
Children of all ages, this is the 411 Ground and Pound Radio Show, your weekly look into the wide, wacky, wonderful world of mixed martial arts. I'm your host, Robert Winfrey, and before we get going, thanks for being here. I know there are hundreds, if not thousands, of MMA-related podcasts out there. You choose this one to, you know, supplement your other listening, because I can't imagine that we're the only one you would listen to. But you have, you know, arrived here, and thank you for that. I've mentioned this frequently in the past, but time is our only truly finite commodity. You have chosen to give of your time to us, and thank you. It means a tremendous amount to me. All right, on the show tonight, we'll be reviewing last night, UFC Fight Night 94, Poirier versus Johnson. An interesting card. There were some questionable decisions, some interesting decisions by the referees, a few very good fights, some pretty good finishes too. So, just a really good all-around card. Very, very short on name value, but barring a few fights, there was only one that was like objectively kind of a snooze fest. I think the rest of them were at least watchable. We will also be previewing next week's card, UFC Fight Night 95 from Brasilia, Brazil. And by the return of Invicta FC featherweight champion Christiane Cyborg Justino as she faces Pig Hostage. I don't necessarily like referring to, people in the main event as a pig hostage, but I know nothing of Lena Landsberg, and unless Cyborg's weight cut goes terribly, and even then, I've got a really hard time seeing her losing that one. There's a couple of other really good fights on that card. Henan Barrows fighting Felipe Nover, Roy Nelson and Bigfoot Silva will square up. Hani Yahya's on the prelims, Gilbert Burns. It's a really solid card. Not a lot of big names, but if you watch a lot of MMA, and I watch a lot of MMA, guys. Yeah, there's some names that you want to pay attention to, so it ought to be interesting. So that's what's on the card for us tonight. If you would like to call in, this show takes live callers. We go live every Sunday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you've got a question or a comment that you'd like addressed by the panel, by all means, call in and do so. The number is 323-657-0901. Once again, 323-657-0901. If you want to call in using Skype, I don't know how successful you will be. Skype and Blog Talk are in one of those phases of their relationship where they are seeking counseling. There is still a Skype icon on the Blog Talk Radio player page. It's on the top of the player, off-center to the right. Click on it. There's some boxes of dialogue you'll have to click through, but by all means, give it a shot. And if you do come up on my switchboard, I will get you on the air. I can't vouch for the reliability. Again, Skype and Blog Talk have a interesting relationship. But, again, you're more than welcome to try. All right. Here with me, back after a week's absence, 411 Mania's jack of all trades. He's in all the zones. Jeff Harris is back with us. How you doing, Jeff?
Welcome back, Jeffrey. You're welcome, Jeffrey. Thank you, Jeffrey.
All right, let's get into this with the main event from last night. Michael Johnson broke a two-fight losing streak by knocking out Dustin Poirier in the first round. Jeff, I don't know if you didn't, again, you weren't here last week. So as we get into the fight, I'm curious, how did you see the fight going, and what did you think about the result?
I, like everyone else, picked Dustin Poirier. I mean, I'm going to own up to it. I put that on my roundtables, but, I mean, even the analyst panel, while picking Poirier for this fight, even Dan Hardy, who has a very high fight IQ, he went for Poirier. I just thought, look, Poirier's weakest area has always been his striking and his head movement, but it looked like in recent fights he had made a lot of strides. I mean, he beat up some high-quality strikers. He didn't show great head movement in this fight, but then again, a lot of fighters in MMA kind of abandon head movement, and they'll just keep their hands pretty low and keep their head straight out for whatever reason. Even top-level fighters do that quite a bit. But he left too many openings, and Michael Johnson made him pay for it. I just figured Poirier would be too well-rounded. He'd use his grappling. I mean, look, Michael Johnson is a very good fighter, but we've seen him get beat up and dominated in the past too many times to my liking, and that's sort of why I didn't pick him here. He's so inconsistent because Michael Johnson will have these runs where he's looking really good, and then in one fight he'll look like he doesn't even belong inside the octagon. Let's not forget it was 3 years ago, but it still happened where he was submitted by Reza Madadi, okay? One fight, he had gone like 3-0 in 2012, and then he got totally dominated by Miles Jury. And Robert, what has Miles Jury done lately?
Dropped a featherweight and got submitted by Charles Oliveira, if memory served.
Yeah, but I mean, does anyone even care about Miles Jury anymore? So that was just kind of my thought process, that Poirier, who's been looking fantastic since he moved up to lightweight, just would have been too much for Johnson. But credit to Johnson, he let his hands go. He looked like $1 million. But let's see. I mean, look, this was one fight, and he just snapped a two-fight losing streak where he hasn't been looking very good. So let's see where he goes from here.
Yeah, I think it was one of the guys in our roundtable, and I forget who, mentioned that he had never accurately predicted a Michael Johnson fight. It's just it's weird to try and get a handle on the guy from an analytical perspective. Honestly, I think the only Michael Johnson fight I've called correctly beforehand was his loss to Beneil Dariush, and I will freely admit that's a virtual clucky decision that went the way of Dariush there. He's just a really hard guy to get a handle on. Very, up and down performances. He's got tremendous hand speed. He's a really good wrestler.
Oh my God.
Got power in his hands, but he struggles when he's not the one dictating the pace. He doesn't have a lot of diversity with his offense. It's basically hooks at the head. And while his wrestling is good, his overall kind of grappling game has been an area of concern for a long time, dating back to when he actually lost to Jonathan Brookins. And it's just hard to get a handle on him. Dustin Poirier did a terrible job with his defensive responsibilities in this fight. And it kind of boggles my mind because, back when his first few UFC fights, it was a clear issue that the guy got hit too much. Didn't move his head, had his hands in improper position. He liked brawling, but grappling was more kind of where he succeeded. And the move to American Top Team did him a world of good. And then in this fight, it was against the one guy who you absolutely must get your head off of the center line when you're fighting. He didn't do it, and he got clobbered because of it. I don't know, just Johnson rising to the occasion, Poirier underperforming a little bit, just a weird, relative to what we all expected to happen, a very odd outcome, but not a bad, I mean, it wasn't a long fight, but I very rarely complain about legitimate first round stoppages, so I credit to Johnson, hopefully he can get a bit of a run going again, And I hope Dustin Poirier bounces back from this. I don't know where each guy goes from here. I'm trying to remember. I think Michael Johnson.
He was ranked number 10 going into this. So it wasn't he was barely in the top 10. So, and Poirier had surged all the way up to number 7.
I think it was Anthony Pettis who put out on Twitter that he would go back up to lightweight to fight Michael Johnson if they could get on the New York card.
Oh my God.
I'm okay with that. I mean, there's a 50-50 chance it's a 15-minute staring contest considering it's those two, but I'm okay kind of taking that risk. As for Poirier, I would need to see the UFC's actual rankings, which I do not have in front of me at the moment. Let me pull those up. I mean, the loss sucks because it's lightweight. You know, one loss can really... I mean, the only guys who kind of matter in that division are the guys who are really consistent, really moving up in the world. Poirier could fight... I don't hate him against either Will Brooks or Ally Aquinta. How is Gilbert Melendez still ranked? What's the matter with you people? Poirier and Dariush kind of strikes my fancy now that I think about it. So I'm okay with those fights. I wouldn't hate Poirier and Nate Diaz either. Just as an outside thought. I know Diaz isn't going to take that fight, but since I can kind of make up what I want here. As for Johnson, again, I don't mind the Pettis fight, and I don't know what Khabib Nurmagomedov is up to. I don't hate him and Khabib either. I would favor Khabib heavily in that fight, and then he could, you know, get a title shot afterwards. Jeff, what do you think? Where does each guy go from here? Who would you like to see them fight next?
I like those fights with Iaquinta or Dariush for both of those guys, but we'll see. I think Iaquinta might have had a fight lined up recently. He was recovering from, like, an injury, and he's been on the shelf a while, but he's doing a kind of like top 10 ranked fight coming up, I would say.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. All right. Co-main event. This one went as I expected it to. It just happened a lot faster than I expected it to. Derek Brunson TKO'd Uriah Hall in the first round. I put this out there and I got a little bit of flack for it. And I'm going to explain my position in a minute, but I think Uriah Hall has been overrated since his time on The Ultimate Fighter, basically. His entire UFC run, the majority of...
You talk about an inconsistent fighter, and
yeah.
That's Uriah Hall to a T.
He really is, and the fact that he got, you know, various rankings and positions and, you know, the way people talked about him, you know, it's not when I tend to feel that if fighters are overrated, it is not the fault of the fighter. They have no control over how other people perceive them necessarily, how they talk about them. Uriah Hall has, first of all, I read a great piece by Jack Slack over at Fightland, who I have to plug more consistently because his writing is excellent. Talked a lot about some of the pitfalls of the spinning techniques that Hall uses, some of his poor decision making. And what struck me in this fight, and I'm going to have to rewatch some of his other fights to really kind of see if this is a pattern. Uriah Hall has power in his hands, but he has terrible punching technique. He's got, you know, really powerful kicks, doesn't mind spinning, good knees. But his punching technique is not good. When he got slammed with the... Because Derek Brunson tagged him with a left hook. He fell down. The referee stopped it. Arguably a premature stoppage, but I can't blame the ref. And honestly, I'm more okay with early stoppages than late stoppages, personally. But he got hit with that punch because he was trying to throw a right hand that started basically at his waist. I know he was worried about the takedown, so his hands were a little bit lower, but you've got to keep, you know, there's a defensive responsibility there that he was not minding. Punches come in straight lines generally, or, you know, from the typical position, for both offensive and defensive purposes, it's harder to get hit, even if you're, you know, in the act of striking, and throwing a punch from down there leaves that entire side of your head and body exposed. And he just got clobbered right in the jaw. I don't have anything against Uriah Hall. I can't pick him very frequently. And given all of his issues, against anyone who knows what they're doing, they're going to beat him. Derek Brunson, I was surprised when I found out he was ranked below Hall. Brunson was on a 4-fight winning streak prior to this fight, whereas Hall was coming off of that loss to Whitaker. And 2 fights before that had been beaten by Rafael Nadal. Hence, a bit of the overrated thing. And, you know, Brunson keeps surging. Derek Brunson's somebody to pay attention to, man. His only UFC loss was to Yoel Romero. His loss prior to that was to Jacare. And then right before that, he had a somewhat clucky split decision loss to Kendall Grove. But, you know, that at that point, it's, you know, enough years have gone by that he's a very different fighter. You got to pay attention to Derek Brunson, man. He's due probably a top five opponent next, and he could be in the title mix sooner rather than later.
Yeah, just the way guys are getting beaten and falling out, and the way, look, that's, I think, 5 wins in a row and 4 knockouts in a row for him as well. Brunson struggled a lot when he first came in the UFC, but lately he's been looking like a completely different fighter, and he's looked a lot more confident. He's pulling the trigger, and, I mean, I don't know what else you can ask for with a guy like that. And he is – I would say he is due for a big fight next, potentially a title eliminator, just with the way he's been – consistently performing and looking good.
Yeah, completely agree. He could fight Robert Whittaker, and I wouldn't complain too much.
If Robert Whittaker and Brunson fought for a title shot next, honestly.
Yeah.
Because Whittaker is way underrated to me at this point and what he's been doing. And, I mean, he beat you. I mean, he didn't finish Uriah Hall, but he beat Uriah Hall coming off an amazing win over Gegard Mousasi. Maybe even put Brunson in there with Mousasi, because Mousasi is a very good MMA wrestler, and he could pose some potential. He'd be a good challenge for Brunson. And Mousasi, he's just sort of been this perennial gatekeeper at this point, where he doesn't win those big important fights, and Brunson is this exciting, surging fighter right now, and I think Mousasi could. It would mean something if Mousasi beat Brunson at this point, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, Brunson should also try to stay on deck. We're talking about a fight between Chris Weidman and Yoel Romero for UFC 205.
Yeah.
Given the history of both of those gentlemen, you want somebody in the on-deck circle for that one. I'll just put it that way. And a rematch with Romero would be interesting. He and Chris Weidman would be interesting. Just Brunson, somebody got to pay attention to. As for Hall, he's going to drop. Has he fought Talos Latus yet?
I don't believe he has. Honestly, I would favor Latus in that fight.
Well, so would I, but if you want to keep him relevant in the top of the division, Latus is
a
good fight.
If you want to kind of, like, you got to give Hall a lower-level matchup next and just see how he does.
Yeah, I wouldn't be opposed to that either. You know, you give him somebody outside of the top 15, this is your generic UFC middleweight. I don't know. I can't think of one off the top of my head.
Or Tim Boach.
Boach could work. Tavares. I kind of like the Tavares fight now that I think about it. Yeah, I think Hall and Tavares would be an interesting pairing. All right, next up. Evan Dunham.
Sam Alvey.
Smiling Sam Alvey. Guy with, incredible punching power against Uriah Hall. Okay, I'm down with that, too. Hall and Sam Alvey could be fun.
Or it could be potentially very weird.
Oh, it'll be weird one way or the other. The question will simply be if it's fun weird.
Yeah.
All right, next up, Evan Dunham defeated Rick Glenn via unanimous decision, 330-27. So the first round was borderline 10-8 from where I sat. Rick Glenn is normally a featherweight, not a lightweight. He took this fight on short notice after Abel Trujillo got injured. Glenn acquitted himself very well for a short notice fight weight class against a longtime stud like Evan Dunham. He got beat comprehensively, but he stayed in the fight, showed some really good submission defense at times. I thought he was done in that first round. Dunham had a really nice choke, rear naked choke going, and Glenn gutted through that and fought
to stay
alive in the fight. It was very impressive.
That was like a zombie performance.
Oh, my internet is flashing. Oh, come on, fix yourself. Okay, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I could hear you earlier. Basically, I'm on board with Rick Glenn definitely deserved another fight after that performance. That fight was basically fight of the night for me. I think Dunham showed some good improvements with his overall striking game in this fight. This is the first time Dunham has gone 4-0 in the UFC since 2010, basically. You know, there was a time where I didn't really see Dunham lasting around much longer. And you know, he's not maybe beating the elite of the division, but he's definitely getting back up there, and I would maybe like to see him in there, either remake the fight with Trujillo or put him in there maybe with the top 15, top 10 guy next to see how he does.
Yeah, I agree. Dunham's really kind of seems to have found himself, and I want to see what Glenn does next with a full fight camp. Probably at featherweight. I mean, he didn't look outsized necessarily, but featherweight seems to be where he's had his most success. So, all right, in the worst fight of the evening, Ron Carnero defeated Kenny Robertson via split decision. 129-28 for Robertson, a 30-27 for Carnero, and a 29-28 for Carnero. This fight was so weird and so kind of slow-paced, had elements of back and forth and whatnot. I could see a 30-27 for either man. I went 30-27 for Carnero, but, I mean, just honestly, I'm not sure there's an improper way to score this fight under the current scoring system. It wasn't a very good fight, all things considered, but from a scoring perspective, it was interesting to me to sit back after the fact and kind of go, there's just not really a wrong scorecard for that fight necessarily. I mean, even Clucky couldn't come up with one. I have no issues with Carnero winning. I would have had no issues with Robertson winning. I mean, the fight was not good, but in terms of the outcome, I don't think either man winning would have been wrong. Jeff, anything you got for this fight?
Nope.
Alrighty. Next up at lightweight, Islam Makhachev defeated Chris Wade via unanimous decision, 329-28. I actually went 30-27 for Makhachev. I thought that even though he was on his back for a chunk of round one, the fact that the majority of the time he was there, he was really close to finishing a triangle at various points, and you're just actively attacking with it. I don't care if you're on bottom, if you're in full guard, if you're the one doing more effective work, you're winning the fight. I felt he was more effective. That said, I do have to rewatch this fight when it becomes available to see if I stand by that when I'm not live blogging it. Rounds two and three were all Makhachev. There were some really good scrambles in this fight. Really good scrambles, really good reversals, transitions, a couple of nice sweeps. Just some really fun, really interesting groundwork being done by both guys throughout this fight. I have to recommend it on that level. I picked Wade. I hadn't seen enough of Makhachev. He'd only had two UFC fights. And one of those was beating Leo Kuntz, and the other was getting knocked out by Adriano Martins. Which is sad, because I should have gone with Makhachev. I have just kind of a general system. I pick good sambo fighters over both jiu-jitsu guys and wrestlers. If your game is relatively one-dimensional, I tend to favor the sambo guys. And Wade's game is a tad one-dimensional. That said, again, I picked him. He's still got some ups. Needs to work on his boxing a little bit, but his grappling game is really, really good. He might be a little bit too accommodating of getting reversed or being on his back, but other than that, really good. Again, he's a talented guy. This was a really good fight, especially, and the exchange that they got into on the ground were really fun, really interesting to watch, at least from my perspective. Jeff, who did you pick for this? Who were you picking for this fight, and what did you think about, a dedicated kind of grappling match that we got?
I liked Makhachev, and it was a good fight. So, looking to see what he does next.
All right, and kicking off the main card, there was no way the rest of the main card was going to live up to this fight. In 19 seconds. Chaz Skelly defeated Maximo Blanco via technical submission. It was an anaconda choke. Chaz Skelly came running out, and Blanco did the same thing. They both came sprinting out. Skelly launched a flying front kick to the body, knocked down Blanco, got on top. Blanco tried to scramble. Skelly locked up an anaconda choke, and Blanco went to sleep. This was, 19 seconds. It was just crazy. I'm a sucker for an anaconda choke. I got a soft spot for them ever since I watched Big Nog submit Heath Herring with one in their second fight. I just got a soft spot for the technique. It was only 19 seconds. I have nothing to complain about. Wild first round finish and a welcome addition to the rest of the card. Jeff, anything on this one?
Skelly is pretty good, man, and I think he's a pretty underrated talent. I know he was coming off a loss here, but he looked fantastic tonight. He went on a run where he fought back-to-back in 2 weeks and won both of those fights.
Yeah, and that loss was to Darren Elkins, right?
I don't think so.
Yeah, no, he lost to Darren Elkins. He lost his UFC debut to Mirsad Bektik.
Right.
Went on a 4-fight winning streak, lost to Elkins, and now beat Blanco. So Bektik and Elkins are two of the top 15 featherweights in the world. Skelly's no slouch.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. On the prelims, Gabriel Benitez defeated Sam Cecilia via technical submission. It was not a guillotine choke, Wikipedia. It was a ninja choke. There's a difference in the grip and some of the positioning, too. With a guillotine, the head is normally by on one side of your body, and you have a very specific grip that you use that I can't describe. I'd have to demonstrate, and since this is an auditory medium, there's no point. A ninja choke actually involves getting the same kind of choking position as a rear naked choke with your arm, in the sense that it's kind of the crook of your elbow around the windpipe, and then the forearm and biceps compressing the carotid arteries on either side. It just, instead of being behind them, you're in front of them, and you have that. Your grip is also not necessarily hand-to-hand, but you have the figure four grip where you're grabbing your own other bicep, and that's providing the squeeze, and their head is in the middle of your chest or your abdomen instead of off to the side, which further compresses things. I've always heard it referred to as a ninja choke, not a guillotine variation, though I could be wrong. And different schools will call it slightly different things. I think I've also heard it called a power guillotine. Just ninja choke is the most common reference. Benitez looked very good. He had some nasty inside leg kicks. He was kind of chewing up Sam Cecilia with a really good performance from him. Bilal Muhammad defeated Augusto Montaño in the third round via TKO. Muhammad, you know, he had a good performance in his debut. It was a short notice loss to Alan Joban, but he put up a heck of a fight. Got to see a little bit more of his skills here. Really good left high kicks from the orthodox stance. Good stuff on the ground. Once he got this fight to the ground, he was able to kind of dominate Montaño there and work him over, and that's what led to the finish. Muhammad's someone to keep your eye on. Middleweight, Antonio Carlos Jr. defeated Leonardo Augusto Leleco Gumarais. Prefers to go by Leleco. Via submission in the third round, it was a rear naked choke. Antonio Carlos Jr. is pretty good, especially on the mat. As long as he was able to get this fight to that position, he was able to dominate, control, and you know, just got to the back and just worked for the choke. At bantamweight, Jose Alberto Quinones defeated Joey Gomez via unanimous decision, 230-27s and a 29-28. No issues with the scoring here. Quinones looked pretty good. Light on his feet, good energy levels, good diversity with his offensive techniques. So good performance from him. At welterweight, Randy Brown defeated Eric Montaño with an anaconda choke in the third round. Was that actually an anaconda, or was that one a darce? I'd have to double-check my coverage. This was a rough fight for Randy Brown. They spent a lot of it in the clinch. Montaño acquitted himself very well for most of it. No, this was an anaconda choke, yeah. I remember now. The arm positioning is what differentiates the anaconda from the darce. Just in that third round, Montaño got a little bit over-aggressive, left his head somewhere it shouldn't have been, and had to tap. Kicking everything off, Alejandro Perez and Alberto Morales went to a majority draw. Perez was deducted a point at the end. These two, this was a weird fight. I scored it for Morales, 29-27 for Morales. Or was it Perez? I think I scored it. I scored it for Perez. These two, I can't keep them straight in my head. I'd have to double check. After the first round, they both threw punches after the bell. Now, I think they both kind of got away with it because the referee did not assert himself between them at the bell, and his call to break was not the loudest. Then at the end of the second, Perez, they kept going a little bit again after the bell. The referee called break, and Perez threw one punch that was very clearly after he had heard the referee say break. So they deducted a point for that one, which is fine. I mean, you have to assert yourself somehow as a referee, and if they're not listening to your commands, point deduction is perfectly viable. Again, I scored this 29-27 for Morales. This whole fight comes down to the second round. Morales had the first, Perez had the third. And if you scored the second round for Perez, you wound up with a draw because of the point deduction. I scored the second round for Morales, so I had it 29-27 for Morales. Weird fight, and it was a weird way to get the night going because you had a referee struggling to kind of get control of things and a couple of needlessly wild fighters. But it was a night of fights. You know, there was only one fight that was, you know, objectively bad. All right, Jeff. That was a decent group of prelims, nothing necessarily special, but you got any burning desires? What stuck out to you from that group of fights?
Gabriel Benitez with the ninja choke, and that's about it.
All right. Thanks to those of you who followed along with my live coverage or read the after report, lowercase j. Your name always makes me smile, by the way. I get a kick out of that one. I know the R was in the report, and I'm forgetting somebody. Ivan or Ivo something, or I forget the last half of his screen name. Thanks to you guys for being there, for reading along, and even if you didn't comment, thank you. Much appreciated, you guys. So thanks again. This coming Saturday, UFC Fight Night 95, the UFC returns to Brasilia, Brazil. There were several fights that got shifted around in this one. due to injuries and whatnot. But the main event is still intact. I mentioned previously, Chris Cyborg, the Invicta FC featherweight champion. Her second fight in the UFC, again at the catchweight of 140 pounds, will fight Lena Landsberg, better known as Pig Hostage at this point. I like Cyborg, generally speaking, and I have no problem with her fighting in the UFC. I really don't have a problem with her doing the catchweight thing either, perfectly honest, doesn't bother me in the least. I just wish she was fighting someone who wasn't there. I mean, look, anyone she fights is generally there to lose at this point, with maybe three or four exceptions. But, I mean, come on. This Lena Landsberg is making her UFC debut here. I'd have to double-check her record. But this is going to be ugly. This is going to be really ugly. Which is fine. I don't mind violence. It's fighting. This is Cyborg all the way. All right, Jeff, is there any realistic chance that Landsberg has of derailing the monster that is Chris Cyborg?
No.
You're not taking the upset here, huh?
I want to, and if I see it, I will be very happy.
Fair enough. All right, the co-main event. Man, Henan Burrell has had a really bizarre career trajectory. I mean, on the scale of Matt Serra to Johnny Hendricks for guys who, you know, won a title and then fell off almost immediately. I don't know. Burrell features on that list. He is on that scale. I mean, he was great for a long period of time. Lost to TJ Dillashaw, beat Mitch Gagnon, lost
for about 10 years.
Yeah, massive winning streak. I mean, and the weird thing about this is, with other fighters who have had those huge winning streaks, elements of it are less than stellar competition. Now, everyone has those phases of their career where they fight less than stellar competition. When you're coming along,
Burrell
that's where
didn't
you're
have that
fighting. No, when he got to the WEC, his entire run in the WEC and UFC, he debuted beating Anthony Leone. He beat Chris Carriasso, both of whom are legitimate guys. Carriasso, you know, went on to fight for the flyweight title. He fought Cole Escovedo, Brad Pickett, and Scott Jorgensen. These guys, those are not scrubs. Pickett's still around, Escovedo kind of fizzled, and Jorgensen might be calling it a career, but he fought them when they were still very good guys. He fought Faber on somewhat short notice, beat Faber, beat Michael McDonald, beat Eddie Wineland, beat Faber again. You know, he didn't fight scrubs. He fought very good guys, and then TJ Dillashaw took a portion of his soul, and he hasn't recovered. He beat Mitch Gagnon, but didn't look great doing so. Lost to Dillashaw again. Moved to featherweight, trying to breathe some life into his career, and got beat by Jeremy Stephens. Now he is getting the gimme of all gimmies. As far as the featherweight division goes, I don't think you can get more of a gimme opponent than Felipe Nover. And here in the co-main event, Henan Burrell fights Felipe Nover. Before I kind of give my two cents, are you, you and I have both kind of called for Burrell. When he's lost, we kind of predicted it because, apart from the first Dillashaw fight, because he just, you know, he has clearly not been himself since. Are you picking Nover here? Does, you know,
no.
Peyton Felipe shock the world and finally
no.
become relevant?
Not at all. No offense to Felipe Nover, but, I mean, his last win in the UFC wasn't even a real win, as far as I'm concerned.
I remember scoring that fight for Yuichi Ulnum.
He lost his last fight. They are really just trying to give Burrell a gimme here to get his confidence back and, you know, to have him stick around, basically, because he's 1-3 right now. And some of those were title fights, but he hasn't looked the same lately. This is again, this is a gimme fight, and he should win here, but we'll see. I have no reason to pick. Even though Barao has not looked great lately, I have absolutely no reason to pick Nover to win this fight because it's Felipe Nover.
I don't think I've ever picked Felipe Nover to win a fight.
And I feel like even if he fights like he did against Steven, he should still win because it's Felipe Nover. So
Nover doesn't have power in his strikes. Certainly not the kind that Jeremy Stevens possesses. He doesn't have the diversity. He doesn't have the takedown defense. And this gets people forget this about Barao frequently. Barao's jiu-jitsu is probably the best element of his game. His takedowns aren't very good. But once things get to the mat, his jiu-jitsu game is excellent. It gets overlooked because he doesn't get to use it. He hasn't used it a whole lot over his last few fights, but that's where he really excels. I think he'll do okay on the feet, kind of, you know, land some good leg kicks or body kicks. As long as he doesn't get into an all-out brawl, he should be fine. Even then, I think he can out-brawl Nover. Take him down, submit him. Henan Barao gets back on the horse, so to speak. All right, next up at heavyweight, Roy Big Country Nelson will fight Antonio Bigfoot Silva. The loser will have to drop Big from their nickname. One will either be Country or Foot. I can't pick Bigfoot. Bigfoot is 1, 2, 4, 5. He is 1-5 with one no contest in his last 7 fights. His only win is over Soa Pelele. He has been stopped by Cain Velasquez, Andre Arlovsky, Frank Mir, Mark Hunt, and Stefan Struve. His chin is shot, and I feel bad for Bigfoot in some ways because the guy has, acromegaly. And the fact that he chooses to fight for a living negates elements of medication that he probably legitimately needs. And he hasn't helped his cause by, at various points in his career, using other steroids. But his chin is shot. At this point, I think I've said it in the past, if you want to beat Bigfoot Silva, you only need 2 things. The ability to remain upright, make a fist, and throw a bit of a punch. Roy Nelson lost a somewhat clucky decision his last time out to Derek Lewis. His recent record is... I thought that was a somewhat clucky decision. He's got this weird record over his last several fights where he had the loss to Lewis, he beat Jared Rochal, he has losses to Josh Barnett, Alistair Overeem, Mark Hunt, Daniel Cormier, and Stipe Miocic. I mean, those are top-shelf heavyweights. He's fighting, the best. He also has a knockout over Big Nog in there. And Roy Nelson is just not going to beat the best guys, but he's going to beat the majority of them. And Bigfoot is as pedestrian a heavyweight as they come at this point. Roy Nelson's going to knock him into next week. Jeff, am I wrong? Are you picking Bigfoot?
No. This should be an easy win by Roy Nelson, but it's still Roy Nelson. So, I mean, look, I got nothing against Roy Nelson, but he's not above making some really boneheaded decisions in his fights. I think it's his own fault that he lost that fight to Derek Lewis. And it wouldn't surprise me if he did something that caused him to lose his fight. But I'm picking Roy Nelson, still Bigfoot Silva, and a simple touch to the chin knocks him out at this point.
Yeah, I don't think he can drive a car legally anymore because the slightest fender bender or a short stop would separate him from his consciousness.
Right.
We've got a really good lightweight fight up next. This is a surprisingly good card, all things considered. Francisco Trinaldo, who is on a six-fight winning streak, coming off of that win over Yancy Medeiros. I mean, look, Trinaldo's never going to be a contender. He is 38 years old, but he's on a great run.
He's a solid veteran, though, and he's on an incredible win streak.
Yeah, he's got one of the longest lightweight winning streaks right now. It's like Ferguson, because Ferguson has a ridiculous number. But Trinaldo is... Yeah, Ferguson is some stupid number. But Trinaldo at 6 is, I believe, number 2 or number 3 in terms of active winning streaks in the lightweight division. And he's fighting Paul Felder. Paul Felder finally a little bit back on the horse. He's on a 2-fight winning streak. And these two guys like to punch. These are both strikers. Felder a little bit fancier. Trinaldo a little bit more traditional. And well, you know, punches, kicks. These two guys are going to throw down. And it's going to be a good one. I'm not sure who to... I can see both guys winning this. So I'm actually leaning Felder a little bit here. He seems to have kind of finally... you know, fix some of the issues he's had in the past, if his last couple of fights are any indicator. And he's, you know, he's gone, you know, tough, hard rounds with guys like Edson Barboza and Ross Pearson. And, you know, debatably won the Pearson fight. I'm leaning towards Paul Felder, but this should be a cracking fight. Jeff, what do you think?
It is a very good fight on paper. Trinaldo, I mean, Paul Felder's an exciting fighter, but Trinaldo is just damn underrated. And I mean, he's been in the UFC. Let me see. Well, he's been in the UFC since 2012. And he's had, you know, some mixed success. But lately, I mean, he's on a 6-fight winning streak. This is a good higher-level fight for him. I mean, he beat Ross Pearson and Yancy Medeiros. And now... let's see, he's up to 1, 6, 7, 8, 9. So he's 9-3 in the UFC. And if he wins here, this could really start putting him up the ladder, start putting him in, you know, against top 15, top 10 matchups.
Yeah, Trinaldo, and some of it's his age, in all honesty. I mean, because, again, 38 and at lightweight. But, yeah, I agree with you. He's a little underappreciated. Very good guy.
That being said, I'm picking Paul Felder just because he has this very crafty, dynamic fighting style. But, again, sometimes he can kind of hold back a little bit. And if he does that here against Trinaldo, that can cost him big time. But I feel like he's getting better, too.
Yeah, that's the fight I think I'm most looking forward to on this entire card. There are some good ones, though. At middleweight, Thiago Santos will fight Eric Spicely. I don't know anything about Spicely, though. I believe he has fought for the UFC before. Santos had a 4-fight winning streak going and then got knocked out by Gegard Mousasi, which, you know, kind of sucks, but Mousasi's a very good fighter. Santos against a guy I don't know anything about. Santos is a violent fighter.
Okay, here's what happened. Spicely lost in his UFC debut to Sam Alvey at Fight Night last July.
Okay. Yeah, this seems like a designated win for Thiago Santos here.
Yeah, this is a you know, comeback win for Thiago Santos, basically.
All right, and at featherweight, Godofredo Pepe Castro will fight Mike De La Torre. Man, Mike De La Torre has had a rough run of things.
He won his last fight, though, even though it was split decision. Against Yui Chulnam. This fight, I'm going with Godofredo Pepe. Godofredo Castro, or Godofredo Pepe, as he's also known. I think his grappling, his BJJ is going to help him out here. He has 8 submission wins, and I'm expecting him to get another submission win here. And I think he's going to get the win over De La Torre. All right, so in the main event of the FS1 prelims, we have Gilbert Burns versus Michael Prazeres at lightweight. Gilbert Burns coming off a win over Lucas Sajewski at UFC Fight Night last July 7th. And then on the other hand, we have Prazeres, who, let's see, he is 4-2 in the octagon, won his last two fights against J.C. Cottrell and Valmir Lazaro. So very interesting fight here. I'm going with Gilbert Burns. I think he's an underrated fighter. He's a good lightweight. I think he's going to dominate and win this fight. Also, we have Hani Yahya versus Michinori Tanaka. Wow, Hani Yahya, he's still hanging in there. He's won his last three, so there you go. And then he's fighting Tanaka. 2-1 in the UFC, so a bit of an interesting bantamweight fight there. Cusier Formiga versus Dustin Ortiz, that's a great flyweight fight. I like Ortiz a lot. He's very fun to watch, and he's fighting Formiga. Lost his last fight to Henry Cejudo, but, you know, he's definitely up there in terms of quality flyweights. And at welterweight, we have Eric Silva. Eric Silva is back. Luin Chagas, you got to win here. You got to win here, Eric Silva. He's looking to snap a two-fight losing streak. On the UFC Fight Pass prelims, we have let's see now, Alan Patrick, and he is fighting Stevie Ray. No, it's not Stevie Ray of the Harlem Heat. Lightweight fight. At welterweight, we have Vicente Luque versus Hector Urbina. And finally, opening the UFC Fight Pass prelims, we have at lightweight Glyco Franca versus Gregor Gillespie. So we have some interesting fights and fighters on the prelims. I think Cusier Formiga versus Dustin Ortiz is a fantastic, fantastic fight. And there's some other decent fight. I mean, Hani Yahya, Tanaka, I think that's a good fight. You got Eric Silva, Alan Patrick. I think he's a good fighter. So we have some good fights up and down this card. So not bad. I mean, it's a free card on FS1 plus five pass prelims, so I don't really have a problem with that. So over in MMA news, we have one of our big fights for UFC 205. It has been announced that the UFC welterweight champion, Tyron Woodley, he is going to defend his title at UFC 205 in Madison Square Garden, and he's going to defend it against Stephen Wonderboy Thompson. I'm so happy this fight has been announced. This is the fight I wanted at welterweight. You know, there was some business about Woodley trying to go for these money weight super fights and what have you, but this fight got made, and I am hoping and praying this fight doesn't fall off, because I definitely want to see this fight. Obviously, Stephen Wonderboy, he's the betting favorite. He's the emotional favorite. Early betting lines still have him winning, and Woodley is the underdog, but that being said, Woodley has been the underdog in his last five fights, and he's won most of them. He was the underdog against Carlos Condit, against Kelvin Gastelum. He was the underdog against Dong Young Kim and against Robbie Lawler, and he won all those fights. The only time he was the underdog and he lost was against Rory McDonald. So I'm very happy this fight got made. Another big item in the MMA news, Chael Sonnen, the American gangster, he is coming back. He is signed with Bellator. Unbelievable. So Chael Sonnen is coming back from his suspension, and he has signed apparently a multi-fight deal with Bellator MMA, and he will be fighting at light heavyweight. I'm not surprised, I guess, in hindsight, but I think a big reason has to be the USADA drug testing. In Bellator, they don't really test you at all, so I imagine that's one reason Chael is going back, medicine or not. He's going back, and he's fighting in Bellator. So a couple big signings for Bellator in the last week. Another one they got was Shane Carwin, the former UFC heavyweight title contender, interim heavyweight champion. Shane Carwin also got signed to Bellator. So Bellator is making some moves lately. I mean, you know, these guys probably don't have any big fights left, but they're being signed for name value, and that's a big reason that Bellator signs these type of guys. I mean, you know, that's why they got Ortiz.
Hear me?
In the late Kimbo Slice. Robert, are you back now?
Yeah, sorry about that, everybody. My Comcast decides, like, every night right around 6:45, apparently my whole area needs to be reset.
So I already ran down the rest of the card. Do you have any other burning desires for the rest of Fight Night 95, Robert?
Yeah, let me run through these real fast. Pepe and De La Torre ought to be decent. I kind of like Pepe's chances. Gilbert Burns and Michelle Prezeris I really like. Gilbert Burns has some phenomenal grappling skills, and I'm really looking forward to seeing how those two will match up. Hani Yahya and Michinori Tanaka is a really good one. Tanaka's coming off of a win over Joe Soto. He's again, these are two very good grapplers that I'm also looking forward to seeing square up. I favor Yahya because he's very good, but that's a really good one. Formiga and Ortiz ought to be interesting. I like Dustin Ortiz's chances there.
That's an
Eric
flyweight fight, by the way.
Yeah. Eric Silva gets a gimme fight over Luan Chagas. That ought to be Silva's. Again, just he's on a two-fight losing streak, but that's Neil Magny and Nordin Taleb, and the UFC kind of likes him winning in Brazil. Alon Patrick and Stevie Ray ought to be good for a throwdown. Those two guys like to scrap. I like Stevie Ray, actually. Luque and Urbina? I don't know. Luque, probably. And Glyco Franca and Gregor Gillespie? Yeah, I like Francis' chances. Excuse me, that's a soft C. So it's a good set of prelims. I mean, not a lot of name value, but there's some guys there who come to fight.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this coming Saturday in the MMA zone of 411mania.com, I will be covering that. Okay, so I apologize for kind of cutting you off when I came back on. What were you talking about
well,
there?
Well, the big news, I guess, is that a couple days ago it was announced that Tyron Woodley has been signed to fight Stephen Thompson for the welterweight title at UFC 205. I think most of us were happy with the news, and I think – I imagine – I know Woodley had voiced his desires of not wanting to fight Thompson and getting money weight fights, but I imagine getting to be a part of the first New York card probably might have persuaded him. But he's fighting the top contender. He's fighting the guy we all want to see him fight. So I have no complaints, honestly.
No, I'm happy the fight got made. I'm happy because it's the fight that should be made. And it's honestly the fight I want to see the most. I want to see Stephen Thompson fight a guy with big power who has a more explosive double leg. And
now,
Tyron Woodley most certainly does.
Now, what do you think? The odds makers have set Tyron Woodley as the underdog. And what I just said was Tyron Woodley has been made the underdog in his last five fights, of which he's won. Let me think. He's won five. Excuse me. He's won four out of those last five, all of where he's been the underdog. He was the underdog against Robbie Lawler. He was the underdog against Gastelum. He was the underdog against Dong Young Kim, and Roy McDonald and Carlos Condit. Of those fights, the only one he ended up losing was to Roy McDonald.
Yeah, he also the only fights he should have been the underdog for, from where I sit, were the McDonald and Lawler fights, just based on existing evidence. He should have been favored to beat Kim. He should have been favored to beat Gastelum, especially after Gastelum missed weight. And Condit, I can see arguments.
Yeah, but
way,
I mean, a fighter misses weight the day before. He doesn't. I mean, you know, you can't.
Well,
it's an odd
fluid thing.
Yeah,
I mean,
but he was still the underdog even after he missed weight. So I mean,
which means a lot of people bet improperly. They should have
but,
a lot of money should have come in on Tyron Woodley for
fair,
that one.
Is it fair that he's still the underdog after knocking out Robbie Lawler, where he was the underdog? And I know we all like Stephen Thompson, and he's on a great winning streak. But, you know, I mean, Stephen Thompson did get beat by Matt Brown earlier in his UFC run. So, I mean, is it a little naive to make him the underdog again, where, as I said, five fights he's been the underdog, and he tends to win most of those fights, four out of five times?
Well, then you should just be happy he's still the underdog, right? That's clearly a winning recipe for him. I'm picking Stephen Thompson, so I suppose by definition I think he should be favored. He should, you know, Tyron Woodley should be more upset that he was an underdog against Dongyun Kim than that he is the underdog here against Stephen Thompson. And the reality is that might change. You know, again, odds go up and down depending on betting patterns and, you know, where the most money is. There's every possibility that come fight night he's the favorite. And I don't see a problem with that, to be perfectly honest.
Also in the news, we had Chael Sonnen and Shane Carwin both signing multi-fight deals with Bellator. Did you have any thoughts on that?
I'm interested to see what Shane Carwin does after, you know, his prolonged retirement. Hopefully he healed up some of the injuries that led to him retiring in the first place. I know he had some pretty serious back problems that were nagging him and really hindering his performance. I'm curious to see what he will do, you know, after that time off. And Bellator's heavyweight division is thin enough for him to kind of run through if he's really back to kind of form.
And Chael Sonnen signing a multi-year, multi-fight deal with Bellator to fight at light heavyweight.
I do not care about Chael Sonnen.
I think there are five letters that explain exactly why Sonnen, you know, coming out of his retirement and his suspension, is signed with Bellator. And do you know what those five letters are?
I imagine USADA.
Yeah. Would I be off there in saying those five letters are why he's in Bellator now?
I imagine they played a significant role.
Significant. Okay.
I mean, if the UFC was paying him enough that it didn't matter that, you know, that he was okay with, you know, being drug tested and failing another drug test, then he probably would still be with the UFC. But between Bellator paying him and, you know, the drug testing that Bellator subjects its fighters to, depending on what state they're in, it makes plenty of sense.
They don't, they're not drug testing guys at all in Bellator.
Well, they don't as a promotion, but, you know, they also go to states where the drug testing requirements are not as stringent as, you know, California, New Jersey,
or the fact
Nevada.
That Kimbo Slice and Ken Shamrock failed drug tests in Texas, of all places, and they turned right around and booked Kimbo Slice to fight again 3 months later before he passed away. So, I mean, just so much.
Well, the extent of Kimbo's suspension from Texas was, I believe, 60 days. They were
which
promotion
is,
well
is
within
nothing.
Their rights
that's,
to...
That's, I mean, that's the average. I mean, that's less than the average turnaround time for, like, a fighter in a big organization. So, whatever.
Look, I don't care about Chael Sonnen. I haven't cared about Chael Sonnen for years. He can fight Tito Ortiz, and we can have a battle to see who is able to cram more sand into their vaginal opening. That's about all I care about for Chael Sonnen. All right, anything else? Because I know Sonnen signing was kind of the biggest news of the week.
Something you said on Facebook. You said I think UFC 203 did sub 500,000 buys.
Initially, it had been reported. That was what Meltzer was saying initially, that it was in the 475 range.
Okay.
Apparently, that was amended after I posted that, and now it's looking to be A little over 600.
Okay, so... So do we have, like... So it was probably over 600, is what you're saying now.
Let me see what's out on the internet,
first,
if we have any...
Okay, first, here's what I was going by what Mike Raimondi and Dave Meltzer were saying in their early projections. Here's what Mark Raimondi of MMA Fighting said. He said it was trending to be the highest grossing UFC pay per view outside of a Ronda Rousey, Conor McGregor, Brock Lesnar card since UFC 183, and that one had 650,000 for Diaz versus Silva. And then UFC 182 had Jones versus Cormier, which did 800,000. So, and then what Meltzer said was, let me see. I think he said that Punk basically added another 300,000 buys to the pay-per-view. So, was that accurate or not?
The UFC doesn't usually release most of their numbers externally. They're not committed.
They never release their pay-per-view numbers.
Unless they do big numbers, then they crow if they do big numbers. But
yeah. But I mean, whenever you see those, they'll put out a number, I think. But you know, do we know that's the exact number, or is that a rounded up number? You know,
understanding is that the information we get about pay-per-view numbers is generally gleaned from conversations between Dana White and Dave Meltzer.
Okay.
And those are, again, not like recorded conversations. They engage in a discussion, and Meltzer is able to make a relatively accurate prediction based on the substance of what they talk about.
So you're saying you were wrong when you said the show did sub 500,000 buys, is what you're saying?
I believe that, yeah. That was what was being reported at the time by Meltzer and Raimondi. Might have been that there were other numbers that had not yet come in.
Why the shift? Because first they're saying it's like one of the biggest, you know, pay-per-views outside of a Ronda or McGregor card, then they're saying, oh, it's much lower, and now it's much bigger again. I don't get the shifting of that.
Well, some of it's just because you're working with very incomplete information at different times. I imagine we're probably going to be in the six-ish range. I'm not sure exactly where when we finally, you know, kind of get something confirmed. Also of note for UFC pay-per-views, I believe they do sell them streaming via Fight Pass now, and it still costs, you know, what a regular pay-per-view costs.
I think you get it at UFC TV, and I think they've had that for a while.
Yeah, my point there is that those numbers are like exclusively UFCs. For other pay-per-views, if you contract, you know, pay-per-view distributors or some of the major television distributors, they will talk about traffic and buy rates for various events through their networks. You know, if you call Dish or Comcast, those numbers can be found in a slightly more circuitous fashion. Anything that goes through, you know, UFC's own properties like Fight Pass or UFC TV is exclusively their own numbers, and I don't believe they release those at all. So there could be... My point there is that there is likely a segment of purchases that are never going to be discussed publicly unless the UFC becomes a publicly traded company. And I don't imagine that happening in the future.
Fantastic. So, and in 3 weeks, we have the rematch of the century, Michael Bisping versus Dan Henderson. Oh, another big fight that got announced. Jacare is going to fight Luke Rockhold in a rematch in Melbourne in November. So that fight.
Like that fight.
I like the fight a lot. I mean, I wish Jacare could have gotten that title shot, but I like this fight as well.
Yeah, Jacare should be fighting for the belt. But The UFC decided that, you know, we're going to try and cash in with Dan Henderson instead of Jacare. And I now fervently wish, not because I dislike Michael Bisping, I have nothing against Bisping, but I really kind of hope that Dan Henderson knocks his head into the fifth row, retires in the cage with the belt, and leaves the UFC having to figure out what to do with Weidman, Rockhold, Jacare, Romero, and Bisping, and a vacated title. Because it would
just... You should just pick that, Robert. Make that
I'm not picking it. I can't, I cannot at this point, I can't in good conscience pick a man who is over 40, has a shot chin, shot cardio, extraordinarily one-dimensional skill set against Michael Bisping. I can't do it intellectually,
okay, so
but
Michael
I will
Bisping,
be rooting for Dan Henderson.
Michael Bisping isn't a young stud. He's got one eye. He's got one good eye. And he tends, you know, he has made a habit throughout his career of making mistakes and hiccups in the cage. And he lost to Dan Henderson before. And he tends to circle into knockout strikes from time to time, and Henderson still has knockout power, even at 46. So
Dan Henderson can win this fight. And look, if his chin was even a fraction of what it used to be, I would probably pick him.
And when Dan Henderson wins, you're going to be devastated and depressed all over this show. And you're going
No, I will be too happy. I will be entirely too happy about Dan Henderson winning the belt to care if I was wrong in my analysis.
A part of you is going to be devastated that you didn't see this and didn't predict this and put your name on it.
A little bit, yeah, but at the same time, again, I can't. I mean, come on. Dan Henderson should have been. Hector Lombard should have beaten Dan Henderson.
You're going to write, well, you know, I should have seen this. Bisping always circles in a head kick. Or a right hand, he does this all the time. I should have predicted this, but I didn't. I kind of see that happening.
I don't know. I don't think I've ever been annoyed if I was wrong in predicting a Bisping fight one way or the other. But again, I'll be rooting for Dan Henderson because, you know, watching him finally get the UFC belt would be awesome. And watching him leave the UFC's middleweight division in an uncomfortable lurch because the UFC decided to be a little bit greedier than usual with this whole situation would just make me happy.
Dan Henderson is not going to retire if he wins the belt. I'm sorry.
Oh, I think he will. He's kind of been vocal about that. I think he wins. He retires on top as champion and lets the UFC sort out that mess.
I don't see it. I'm sorry.
As I mean, if he sticks around, he's not getting a single title defense. There's no way. Come on. I have a ton of respect for Dan
Henderson.
Fighters
just don't do that. A fighter at Dan Henderson's level, they don't retire on a win, and they just don't want to. And even if they say they retired, they end up coming back sometime later and keep fighting.
If he decides to come back in 2 years for kind of a one-off thing, I'm okay with that. I don't know. Again, I don't know if he'll stay retired, but I think he is going to retire after winning the belt for a period of at least a year.
Fedor did it, for that matter.
He did. And I kind of wish he'd stayed retired, but such is life. All right. Anything else in the news, Jeff?
Those, I think, were the big items. I think we covered just about everything.
All right. What do you got to plug, then?
All right. So this week, reviews coming up. We'll have the new family animated movie, Stork. Starring Andy Samberg and Kelsey Grammer. Also, Anton Fuqua's remake of The Magnificent Seven, one of the greatest Western movies of all time. This new one stars, let's see, we got an all-star cast, Denzel Washington, Chris Pratt, Vincent D'Onofrio, Peter Sarsgaard, Ethan Hawke. So you have a pretty prestigious cast all lined up here. You have the, you know, the Training Day director and Scar back together again, and it's a Western, and it's a remake of one of the all-time great Westerns. So, any
which is itself
that,
just a remake of one of the best samurai movies ever.
Which itself just sort of greatly inspired by Hollywood Western. So, you know, it's kind of all coming first full circle if you think about it. Did you know that?
Yeah, no, I Kurosawa has a took a little bit of inspiration from some of those black and white Westerns of the time.
So, but at least with the Magnificent Seven, it was a reinvention in, you know, different, and they changed the title at least. So, I mean, but I think this has sort of become sort of a stock plot, as it were, just for narrative, you know, narrative media in general. Like I've lost count of the number of Star Trek episodes, basically the Magnificent Seven scenario, or you know, just, you know, just going with the Kurosawa thing in general.
It's almost impossible to get away from Kurosawa's films.
Yeah, it's almost like Kurosawa like basically invented narrative archetypes that are basically recycled ad nauseum for the last century, almost.
Pretty much.
60, 70 years at this point. So, yeah, those two movies I'll be doing, so be on the lookout for those. So, thank you, guys.
All right, I'll see you next week, Jeff.
Bye-bye.
All right, as for me, there is still no movie review with Mark as of yet. Next Tuesday, we'll be back with The Magnificent Seven. That'll be an interesting one. However, we are currently engaged in Alan Moore Month here on the Rattle Etch and Broadcasting Network. Last Thursday, I did kind of a last-second guest spot talking about The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, comparing and contrasting the written work with the film adaptation. There is no comparison on that one. The books are so much better. This coming Thursday, continuing the theme of, you know, examining Moore's works and their adaptations, we'll be talking about V for Vendetta, my favorite adaptations of his work, and not a bad story to begin with, so that'll be an interesting one. And then the Thursday after that, it concludes with From Hell. Oy. That's going to be an interesting one. So you can, if you're interested, 9:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Thursday evenings on the Rattle Etch and Broadcasting Network. This coming Saturday, again, UFC Fight Night 95 ought to be interesting. Cyborg's going to kill someone. And next Sunday, right here, we will be reviewing UFC Fight Night 95. And previewing UFC Fight Night 96. 96 is a really good card. Headlined by John Lineker and John Dodson. Those two guys have incredible power, not just because they're bantamweights. Those guys hit hard. Will Brooks will fight Alex Oliveira, Joaquin Diaz, and Andre Feely. Yeah, I don't care about that. Flyweight, Lewis Smolka and Sergio Pettis. That's a heck of a fight. There's heavyweights because God hates me. Tamden McCrory and Nate Marquardt, potentially interesting. Josh Berkman's on the card. He was supposed to fight Bobby Green. Bobby Green pulled out, apparently. It's not a bad card. So we'll be previewing that next week. I hope you'll all come back for that one. Should be fun. Until next time, then, for Jeff Harris, I'm Robert Winfrey, reminding everyone out there to please continue to be well, be safe, and behave.